Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
This is Lori McCandish King reporting from Berkeley, California. I'm visiting today with Perry Garfinkel, longtime New York Times contributor, writer, writing teacher, author of the book Travel Writing for Profit and Pleasure, maybe the emphasis on pleasure these days, and also author of a book I thoroughly enjoyed, Buddha or Bust.
Which, by the way, is in the category that we dubbed Spiritual Travel Adventure Memoir.
Wow, that's a mouthful. Is there a shelving category called that?
No, we had to build a whole wing of all the bookstores for that. And the subtitle of the book also needed its own shelves. It's In Search of Truth, Meaning, Happiness, and the Man Who Found Them All.
That is very comprehensive.
Started as an assignment for National Geographic magazine, and I was on the journey. In fact, I was in Bodh Gaya, India, where the Buddha was enlightened, when my agent tracked me down and said, we have a book offer. And so after I finished the journey around the world, literally for the Geographic, I came back, unpacked and repacked, and took off again for another 10 weeks to go back and I got to interview the Dalai Lama in India and a couple other famous Buddhist teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh. It was the year 2004. I was on the road half of that year.
Must have been a fabulous project.
Every day I pinch myself that really I'm on assignment for National Geographic. I have a nice book deal, and I'm interviewing some of the most famous people in the world. That, some of the most poignant experiences I had in my life. I interviewed untouchables in India who had converted to Buddhism. And I saw the rich and the famous and the poor and the rich inside.
You mentioned the untouchables, and one of the things that I think was interesting about your book was that it not only talks about the history of Buddhism as it moved to the West and then that fascinating doubling back that you talk about that it did, but also the aspect of engaged Buddhism.
Yes, I needed a news hook, as we say, especially for National Geographic magazine. And there is a movement in Buddhism that is called socially engaged Buddhism. So my task as a journalist was to show the history of Buddhism around the world, following the footsteps of the Buddha, and then trace the evolution of this engaged movement from country to country, paralleled with some historical point in the history of Buddhism. So, for instance, I went to Sri Lanka, where one of the largest NGOs in the world has a Buddhist philosophic foundation to it, and Sri Lanka was the second country in the world to which Buddhism got exported in the time of King Ashoka of India. You know, I've been practicing Buddhism for a long time, and there is an overlap between my practice of Buddhism and what I know about writing and what I learned as a journalist and especially as a travel writer to be here now, you know, in anywhere I am in the world.
I thought that was one of the most interesting things that I read when I was reading what you had written, the intersection of travel writing, because that's an interest of mine, and Buddhism, and that New York Times opinionator piece that you wrote, which you didn't really say was about Buddhism, but it seemed like it was, the here and now. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when I teach travel writing workshops, I start off every class with an exercise that goes like this. Take 5 minutes and write as many sentences as you can, each sentence beginning with the words, here and now I am. And what that effectively does is bring you into the here and now, in which all you have to draw on is your senses. So the sounds of birds chirping in the background, the feel of air across my face. And so that translates into good travel writing, because the best travel writing gives you the sense of place, sense of being there. And how do you convey being there? Except by the five senses. So the smells, the sights, and the sounds, and the degree to which you can come up with the compelling words to make me feel there as the reader, it makes for good travel writing. And by the way, you're there. You're really there. And I really abhor cameras sometimes, because especially, you know, cameras on phones now, nobody's actually looking at it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They're looking at their camera looking at it. So I want to be that camera. That camera is seeing a lot of the world, and you are not.
And as you pointed out, we are the cameras, we're the recorders, and it's not just the visual sense that we have. It's all those other senses that bring so much life to good travel writing.
The other thing that exercise evokes is not just a sense of being there, but I find that writing is like thinking, except it's put on paper. So it naturally, we go from the perspective to the extrospective. You go from the inside to the outside, from the microcosm of my experience to the macrocosm of how does my experience relate to the potential reader. And that way to connect to the reader is the bridge from, you know, I to you, to us. So that little exercise does that. It always does that. And as I give this exercise every time, people go, you know, here and now I am wondering why I am here and now. The winner of this exercise is, you know, here and now I am, period.
Do you have other exercises that you recommend or other just other recommendations for travel writers or writers in general who are trying to be more here and more attentive to what's around them?
Yes. One of the things I recommend in helping a writer focus on what the story is about is to start write a paragraph that begins with the words, "This is a story about." And, you know, in less than 100 words or in two or three sentences. And I find that, again, the microcosm and the macrocosm of that answer. The microcosm would be, this is a story about a guy who goes to Sri Lanka and visits the Temple of the Tooth. The bigger this is a story about could end up being, this is a story about my search for a belief system. So you sort of ramp up to the bigger one. But this is a story about the way to help you focus on the idea and let the kind of cream rise to the top as you go from the microcosm to the macrocosm.
And that's almost like the nut graph that a writer would put in a story.
Exactly.
So you trick your students into writing the nut graph. I think that's the hardest thing to do is get that nut graph.
Lori, maybe I should explain the nut graph to those who may not know. The nut graph, with sometimes it's called the keystone paragraph, is probably the third paragraph after your little intro and your backing in or whatever you do. And it's to say why you should be reading this story. What are the touch points? What's the connect? Readers sometimes need to be hammered over the head of why they're reading it. You can't be so slick and graceful as to just assume everybody knows what's in your head. And it's a very, very concrete explanation. And it could be just, this is the last lighthouse on the West Coast, or any other superlative, the tallest, the shortest, the only, or that there's some environmental reason to do this story, as the oceans disappear, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what the nut graph is. The other key to writing that a lot of people forget about is the transition. It's a segue that makes I call it a swinging door. You don't have to think in segues and naturally. You can write your paragraphs all over the place, but then there's a game I play of, okay, how do I connect that paragraph so that the reader thinks I just thought this all out logically and sequentially, which I never do.
That's good to hear. I always have to go back and do the transitions, too. They don't seem like they flow naturally for me either. But, boy, when you get a good transition, it's so gratifying. It really helps the piece so much.
Yeah. One of the little tricks I've used often is what I call the echo transition. So maybe in the last 10 words of the paragraph, I invoke that very same word or a spin on that word into the beginning of the next paragraph. So the reader sees, oh, I see his where he was going, why he went there.
Other kinds of transitions?
Well, there's one called the abrupt transition, I call it, which is just, you know, and it's sort of a graphic thing. You don't just double space, you triple space, or you put little asterisks in between, and it just begins with a complete scene change.
So that's kind of a non-transition in a way.
Yeah. If filmatically one is a dissolve, the other is like a do.
Yeah.
and sometimes to sort of make the jolt realistic and, you know, real, I quote somebody. Mm-hmm. Somebody saying something that breaks you away from the last scene and opens up with a visual of, and I say, you know, stop, she said as she swept her hand across the sky or something, so the reader not just hears a person but sees a person.
So it's almost like a whole new lead at that point.
Yes.
And so what about leads and kickers?
Ah, leads are easier than kickers. Laura's using all the jargon of writers.
Oh, you can clarify it for us.
A kicker is an ending, but the lead takes me days sometimes to come up with because I just keep letting the "this is a story about" marinate with me. Sometimes I write other paragraphs before I know what the lead will be, but I keep thinking, what is the hook? What's the most potential for pulling in the reader in a powerful way without using cliches? And a good lead is an arrow that points to the whole rest of the story. So you're alluding to a lot in a very succinct lead, but it's like peeling an onion, mm-hmm. layers upon layers. Endings are tricky, and sometimes it's all about the word count. So if you're assigned to write a story of 1,000 words, yep. I know how to pace it out. I know how many ideas I can get into 1,000 words. I don't know the ending until I'm like at about 800 words. And then I have this, oh my God, I got to finish this piece. I have to wind my way down to the ending. I almost hear organ music. A good lead, to me, circles back to the beginning. So an idea you had at the top, and it's not such a cliche. And so now you know everything there is to know about Calistoga. It's more like taking a thread that was, you left a little dangling thread at the top, and you can reinvoke it and bring some closure. Another good ending is, where do we go from here? You know, what's the future of this destination or this mode of travel?
And speaking of pacing, you've also written about rhythm and writing. What about that?
I should precede it by saying I'm a lifelong percussionist. My mother says I was playing drums inside her before I came out. But started teaching writing, I looked at my own work and I realized there is a rhythm to my writing. And for me, it's because I've been playing drums my whole life. But I saw that there was a certain kind of pattern. Recognizing it, I could follow it. I could also divert from it. So if I'm writing short staccato sentences, it's a good time to write a long, complex mm-hmm. sentences. And, of course, the opposite. A compound, complex sentence, as long as it's not obscuring your meaning, works. But I find it's a nice counterpoint to write like a five-word sentence after that. And it makes you absorb the previous sentence with an observation or a visual. I'm a big fan of alliteration. Some people call it lazy man's, out excuse. But I find alliteration has a rhythm to it. It's like I find the beat in the letters or the sound, and I'm creating a rhythm within the sentence that's pretty subliminal.
It's fun, too.
Yeah. It just falls out of my typewriter. The other thing about rhythm and writing is the triplets. Often, and you can look this up, Google the rule of three. It's rampant, and I never realized it, but so many phrases have this, this, and that. That, and that. Peace, love, and happiness. Life, love, and the pursuit of happiness. It's all about happiness, yeah. Isn't it? But I use that too, and I didn't realize that, oh, I learned as a drummer to play triplets. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's a triplet. I can do, we joked about before, I can do triplets with my right hand and 4-4 time with my left hand. So I can do 3/2, 3 and 2 combined. So the right side and the left side of my brain are at work. Naturally doing threes with one hand, but then really pushing my brain to think in twos with my left. I think that too has informed my writing. And I think also I can hold different thoughts at mm-hmm. the same time. This does not explain why I'm so forgetful nowadays.
You hold selective thoughts.
Yeah,
hold thoughts selectively.
Now I hold random thoughts, but in triplet form.
Let's talk a little bit about voice and point of view, too.
One of the ways I developed voice was to, I was insecure about my writing early on. I was told that I speak well, so I turned on a tape recorder, and alone in a room, I would talk my story through. And then I would take that tape of a talk and transcribe it literally, mm-hmm. and I found I had the beginning, like a rough draft, a very rough draft of what I think and how I would say it. And then I would work from that, and that seemed to work well. Every good story has a point of view. However, not everybody wants to read about you. They want the point of view without the words I, me, or my.
How do you do that? How do you get the I, me, and my out of there?
Well, my training came as a reporter, as a journalist, where you're not, except for essays and op-ed pieces, you don't use the words I, me, or my. But I quickly realized that you could create a point of view by deciding what you were going to include and then using adjectives that describe the place or the thing or the person that don't have to say, this is what I think of this person, or that hat is ugly, but you can just describe. In the writing world, we call it show, don't tell. So I'll say the hat had a dead bird sitting on the top of it, which you can decide yourself if that's ugly or not. And then picking out the details that tell the reader what you think of something. And I look for details. I seem to have a shoe fetish. And I notice women taught me this, that shoes define the man. So I often look at some what their style is. If they're wearing penny loafers, they're, you know, Brooks Brothers type of, you know, button-down kind of guy. If they're wearing Birkenstocks, they're from Berkeley and stuck in the 70s. And, you know, picking out the details, that God is in the details, and that helps develop a point of view. And back to the voice for a second, I think the writing comes from the oral tradition. So some people have this feeling that if you talk your story through too many times to friends, you lose it, you spend it. I don't believe that. I think talking about it helps you refine what works. If I'm trying to write a funny line and I use it on a friend and they like go, what? Then I know that's not that funny. Or maybe it's the way I delivered it. I learned a lot from reading about writers of comedy and how they save the kicker word for the last word in the sentence so that there is a kind of rising hope and expectation and the drop line is the last word. I've been informed by some great humor writers. The other thing about voice is I steal freely. I'm being a little facetious, but my inspirations were everyone from Woody Allen to John McPhee. John McPhee writes very descriptive prose, but at the end he'll put a kicker sentence in that paragraph that tells you what he thinks about it without using the words I, me, or my. Woody Allen is just, you know, a riotous as a slapstick kind of humor writer for The New Yorker, and I read all his books of essays of collective stories, and that sort of became part of my voice. And in the beginning, I just tried to be like Woody Allen. And then I said, oh, no, that's not me. That's me trying to be Woody Allen. But I think modeling after the masters is a good way to see where your voice could take off from these other voices.
Kind of the way painters in olden days were trained, copying the masters and then learning to do it themselves.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. In fact, the great modern artists all started with studying classical art. My classical art was journalism. So the reporter's style was what I did. Eventually I thought, well, this formula feels confining. So I moved into the magazine world, which was a little more open. And then when I got to write books, I was like, wow, I don't have to follow anybody's formula. It was scary at first. And then I realized, oh, I'm the editor. And so the rivers flowed freely.
Interesting the ways that you relate writing to other parts of life. Another thing that I thought was something that I'd like to explore with you is that Daniel Goleman article where he talked to you about how to bring your vacation home with you. And part of that was to be aware when you're on vacation. What you were explaining was to be aware when you're on vacation.
A little bit of that practice of mindfulness and being present in the present moment helps you bring the vacation home with you. Let's talk about writers. If you go away on assignment and you're so obsessed with getting to this point and that point on time, you have your notes, you have your maps, you know, you're interviewing, you're at work, really, you're not stopping and enjoying it. And I know as a longtime travel writer, there is that moment when you say, I'm supposed to be having fun because my reader wants to go there for fun. So I allow myself to just be there and feel it. And because I can hold these two things at once, I'm on assignment, but at this point in my life, it's seamless. There's no difference between my life and an enjoyment of my life and being a writer and a travel writer on assignment. But I am like a camel. I can hold these feelings for a long time. And so when I go home, I can kind of, like a camel or like a cow, I can regurgitate the experience and kind of chew it again and savor it, which is really powerful for when I want to write it finally, because I can bring the there and then into the here and now so that the reader can feel here and now whenever they read it, there, then, or whenever.
I imagine that having really taken the time to relax and be there then is what allows you to absorb the experience enough that you're able to recall it later. Do you have any suggestions for how all of us, not just writers, but how all of us can be able to incorporate our experiences or remember our experiences better or experience our experiences?
Very well put. So how to experience your experience better is to be in the experience. There is that phenomenon in physics called the observer and the observed.
Yeah.
I've thought about this a lot because as a cub reporter, I would be at the edge of an experience with my notebook, watching inside. And half of me wanted to be in there and doing it. So I've managed to kind of balance that experience. I stand on the outside. I sort of figure out what's going on. I take some notes. And then I kind of put my notebook or my tape recorder in my pocket. And I go. I dive into the experience. And I try hard to forget that I'm the journalist on assignment. Those are the memories that I take back and when I go to write that I know will be most related to the person who's reading it, because the person who's reading it is not necessarily a writer. So the sense of being there without being on assignment is what they want to feel. But I struggle with that. It's a struggle.
I find that, too, when I'm traveling and writing. I'm taking notes, I'm taking photos, and I sometimes find that I'm not enjoying myself as much as I wish I were, and I'm not even paying attention in the way I wish I were.
I want to bring up the flip side of that, and it's what I call the travel writer's mindset. Mm-hmm. The travel writer's mindset helps the vacationer become a travel writer, because I think we as travel writers, when we're doing this right, we absorb a lot more. We want to know how many feet tall that is, and tall compared to what. We want to go interview people and not just say, hi, how are you, where are you from? Really kind of probe them about their cultural mindset. So I encourage people to adopt the travel writer's mindset, because I'm sure it enhances your travel experience. Hemingway was one of my great role models. He said, writing is very easy. All you do is start with one true statement. Well, that's the hardest thing you can do, because to me, a true statement is what is your truth in relation to this thing, this idea, or in the case of travel writing, to this place. And when you talk about place, you have to wrap it in the cultural blanket that this place comes in. So if we're looking at aspens in Colorado, you have to understand the history of aspens. You have to understand the geology of the Colorado Range of Mountains. There's a lot to, one true statement. And it really comes down to what is your personal truth. So that's a good quote.
It's a great quote. How is writing about place different from other kinds of writing? Or is it not?
A lot of other writing is about ideas or feelings. Writing about place is very concrete, this place. And then, of course, it feeds into feelings. But you have to start with something really rooted in the place itself. And that, not to be redundant, but this goes to being here now.
It also relates to that Buddhist approach of what's real, what's here, what can I see and feel and hear.
Just to be clear, Buddhism is not a religion. The Buddha intended Buddhism to be a psychology, a path to happiness. So I don't wear saffron robes. I don't even say I'm a Buddhist. I'm not a Buddhist. I practice meditation and compassion and empathy. That may relate to the sense of place because, I have empathy for people. One of my abilities as a good writer is to find a common ground between me and who I interview. There's like 2 degrees of separation between my life and yours, and finding that bridge helps us be together. And the sense of place sort of goes ipso facto to people in the place. Mm-hmm. So people in places we talk about. One of the things I learned from being a good reporter that I apply to travel writing is to quote people. There's a lot of travel writing you see that you don't feel like you're meeting other people. It's like, I went here, there, and everywhere. Or the opposite is it's all in the third person and we just get too much of place and not enough people. when you quote somebody who sounds really like themselves, you feel that's your connection. We're connected to people in a place. Mm-hmm. And it brings a person to life by quoting them and showing them. So that's one of the other things I bring as basically a good cub reporter.
And as an instructor. So tell us a bit about this class you have coming up.
I'm really looking forward to teaching a writing workshop on Martha's Vineyard on the East Coast, where I lived for 12 years year-round and wrote at least two books, maybe close to three, and hundreds of articles. This will be a five-day immersion writing experience. So we'll go out on assignment on the beautiful island of Martha's Vineyard. Guests who come from off-island are being put up at an inn where the workshop will take place. It's an opportunity to refine your skill, but also meet with like-minded people. And there's all kinds of idea generation that happens among a group of people who write. Writers are good thinkers. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's August 30th to September 5th. You can go to my website where I'll post a link to registering for this class, and you can find out more about it, perrygarfinkel.com. My name is spelled PerryGarfinkel.com.
We add that to our names now.
I like to quote, is it Voltaire or Descartes? I have a website, therefore I am.
That's Descartes. Descartes.
I have a website, therefore I exist.
Okay, and a little bit more about what you cover in the class.
What we cover in the class is everything from the process of writing, the psychology of writing, the formula, the things that we've discussed about here, beginnings, middles, and endings, how to weave in quotes so it sounds very seamless. Then we have what I call editorial brainstorming sessions where people pitch ideas and we help people refine their ideas. And then the fun, exciting part is also we have in-class writing drills, like 5-10 minutes just to get you pumped up. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of times, first of all, because I know Martha's Vineyard so well, but also because I want this to be experiential, we'll go out on assignment for a half day, notebooks and digital devices in hand. And then I'll come back and I'll give you like a drop-dead deadline to write me 250 words or a 3-paragraph lead. I'm going to have some guest speakers who, because I know writers and photographers on Martha's Vineyard, we'll talk about photography. Then once I feel like you understand how to write well, we'll talk about markets and the changing landscape of markets. To blog or not to blog, that is the question.
And that was Shakespeare.
And then we'll talk about how to market yourself, you know, and how to get more assignments and also practical advice for in the field. People get to know each other in these workshops. I think we're going to limit it to 12 people, so it'll be a small group. And come one, come all.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
I'm told I'm fun to be with.
It's true.
I'm just reporting the facts.
Thanks so much. We've been talking with Perry Garfinkel, author of Buddha or Bust, and teacher of an upcoming class on travel writing that will be on Martha's Vineyard.
August 30th to September 5th.
2015.
Again, the website is my name, perrygarfinkel.com.
Thanks so much, Perry.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
You've been listening to Lori McCandish King, associate producer of the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, featured weekly on NPR.org's digital media podcast site.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort Maui at Wailea invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was recently awarded the prestigious Phoenix Award by the Society of American Travel Writers. HLRI was one of four recipients of the prestigious award that recognizes international organizations actively involved in conservation, preservation, beautification, and anti-pollution campaigns that further the growth and appeal of travel destinations.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning, and Lauren Hayes is our technical assistant.